accession number 31509, Rule 12.
Let me just check the rule. That I've got all this right. Gavin Douglas, Reel 12. Yes, I suppose this you must be very interested in what's going on in this region today, Gavin. And probably you, amongst a lot of people who are totally ignorant of this area, must know the problems of fighting in that area.
Well, yes. It's a part of the world where life is very difficult for people who live there. They're very hardy people. They have to be to be able to survive in the mountains. They have very high codes of honor. They're always at each other's throats. If you murder somebody or kill somebody, it starts a life vendetta. It can be somebody in the next village, and they remain enemies for generations afterwards. It's always been that way, certainly for the last 1,000 years, where man is against man because it's a question of survival in a terrible climate, in an unproductive area. Having said that, however, one of the things that does grow in that very poor soil that's in Afghanistan across the border are poppies. And, of course, from poppies, they now are making a lot of money because it's converted into opium and the various opium derivatives, and sells at an enormous price on the streets in big cities in the West, particularly in London and places like Manchester and Birmingham. And it's the most profitable crops they can grow. And unless some other crop can be found that will also grow there, which they can make money out of, which they gladly change to. If you find us something else to sell you, we won't go on growing poppies. But that's only one side of it. The Pathans are a warlike race, and as I say, when they're not fighting outside forces, they're fighting against each other. They have these life vendettas. It's rather like, in some ways, Corsica and the Balkan states. They are people who are always at war with each other. The Islamic code is, of course, something they follow very closely. It's largely the very ignorant that behave badly over it, they have been taught or told by their teachers, their mullahs, their preachers, a lot about what rewards they will get in heaven for killing non-believers, in other words, people who are not Mohammedans, and they take it very literally. They're very excitable people, they're easily worked up, and of course they're a darn nuisance to everybody else when they get a bee in their bonnet about something, some injustice, or on the other hand, they want something done their way, and they go ahead and we have to try and prevent them from doing it. In the old days, as I said, we had the political department up there, and the political officers used to talk to the tribal chiefs and try and negotiate with them. And in fact, there were times when the political department were rather disliked by the army because it almost seemed the political department was on the side of the Pathans, with whom they appeared to be siding because of the injustices the Pathans told them. So It's such a huge subject, not one that I could really go into here.
But the little you've told me, you know, it seems that, you know, the coalition in Afghanistan have got a very difficult job on at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. They're an undisciplined lot. The few disciplined Pathans and Afghans, of which there are some, are hopelessly outnumbered by the rest. Yeah, they're brigands, and they have brigand chiefs, and who answer to nobody. They won't even answer to their own chiefs sometimes, and their government officials. There have been several kings in Afghanistan, and it's been very difficult to hold their position. They've been unseated, and somebody else has gone in. It's a violent country.
Do you have any hopes that we can achieve anything there, or do you think we're wasting our time?
Well, there are times when I think that whether it's Afghanistan or Sudan, we should let them get on with their own business and let them kill each other off instead of getting involved and making ourselves unpopular. I know that's not a popular view amongst the do-gooders, but the do-gooders are never there themselves, so they theoretically, what they say and that is right, but it just doesn't work.
So how long were you up there in that area?
Well, as far as the Air Force was concerned, and it was all tied up with the fact that India was going to get its independence. And a lot was going on behind the scenes in London and elsewhere, which we were not aware of at the time. But 152 Squadron had already been earmarked to go to the Indian Air Force. And this, I was the last CO of 152 Squadron, because soon after, I think there may have been somebody holding it for a short time, but soon after I was repatriated to England in January, February of 1947, India and Pakistan got their independence in September of 1947, and by that time all this negotiating was going on, it was where the frontier was and which regiments were going to go to Pakistan and which regiments were going to stay in India and which regiments were going to be divided up, because in my day and before my time, the Indian Army never had, except in the early days, entirely one set of people in it. We for example, in all my squadrons, there were three squadrons. There'd be one of Hindus, there'd be one of Sikhs, and there'd be one of Islam, of Muslims. And of course, when Pakistan came into being, all the Muslim squadrons and Indian squadrons would go to Pakistan, and those that were up in Pakistan at the time, who were Hindus, would be sent to join Indian regiments, which would no longer have Islamic regiments squadrons with them. Yes.
That must have been a very big job.
It was a shambles, an absolute shambles. Right up to the last minute, I forget the name of the gentleman who was supposed to be drawing the frontier line between India and Pakistan. But right up to about a week or 2 weeks beforehand, it hadn't been completed. And, well, everybody knows the story of what happened then. India and Pakistan got their independence one day apart. And in that time, there was insurrection on both sides. Mohammedans trying to get to Pakistan were being slaughtered, and Hindus trying to come the other way, and Sikhs to go to India, who had lived for years and years for hundreds of years in the other side of the newly drawn line, had to get over to India, and they were being slaughtered. At least 1 million people were murdered in that period of 4 to 5 weeks that bracketed the independence. And of course, since that time, India and Pakistan have been at war on paper. It's quietened down in recent years, but they actually had a 6-day war, I think, it was something like that, round about the, let's see now, it would be 1952, in the early 60s. And India, of course, had a much larger army than the Pakistan, but at any rate, it fizzled out. It was, they came to terms. But it was all over the still ongoing question of who is going to hold Kashmir. Kashmir is peopled mainly by Muslims, and they want to be with Pakistan. And India doesn't want to let go of Kashmir. Pandit Nehru was a Kashmiri himself, and because of that, and politically, Kashmir has always been part of India. And this is an ongoing bone of contention. When I say that Kashmiris want to be part of India because they were all part of Pakistan, beg your pardon, because they were Muslims, that's not entirely correct. At the beginning, Kashmir would have preferred to have its own independence. More jobs for the boys, they'd have their own rulers, they'd have their own political departments and so on and so forth. They didn't really want to be part of Pakistan. They didn't really want to be, certainly didn't want to be a part of India. And I spoke to many Kashmiris myself when I was up there in this period as they were trekking. I was there fishing, I was talking to Kashmiris that I knew, and at the time, of course, the Hindus were in power. And they said, Saab, we want independence, like everybody else. We want to be like Switzerland. We don't want to be part of either of the countries. We want to be on our own. But I suppose, faute de mieux, they would prefer to be with an Islamic organization than with a Hindu.
Did you see yourself any of these murders and the atrocities that were occurring? I know you did explain that you'd had a journey where you witnessed something. I wonder if you could tell me about that, Gavin.
Well, first of all, when I was sent back to India to rejoin my regiment, after 6 months' leave in England, I had left the Air Force. I was back with my regiment on paper. I arrived back in Delhi from England by air a few days after independence had been declared. And I was staying with a friend and his wife whom I had known before the war. He was in the Wiltshire Regiment in the Madras when I was in ADT as the governor. And they very kindly put me up in their flat, which was in the second row of Connaught Square. Connaught Square had all the big shops in it, in New Delhi, and also outside these big shops were lots of smaller, for want of calling them shops, they were sort of I don't know, they were pavement shops. Made of wood and anything, in all around Connaught Square, where small traders traded whatever they were trading in, but mostly domestic items. I don't remember seeing any food, but silks and materials and gimmicks and knives and whatever. They were all trying to make a living. And they had built their little shops on the pavements outside these big shops, which were part of Connaught Square, which was Connaught Circus, which of course was designed by Latins. They were a growth that had usurped. They were illegally, probably, but like India, they just grew up everywhere. When these murders started taking place between Indians and or Hindus, I should say, and Mohammedans, there was another element in India that has always been there, which is known as the Gunda element. They are the riffraff of the bazaars. We have them in every country. We have them even in this country, but not to the same extent. And they will profit if there's anything going on. It's the freebooters and looters. And I watched these little shops outside the big shops, built of matchwood, some of them, being looted by the Gundas. And the police were around in big trucks, armed police, and they were shooting the looters. And I watched them from the balcony of the house, and they would pick up the body after it had been shot, and it would be thrown at the back of a truck, and they'd go on and shoot a few more, and eventually the truck was full of bodies, and then they would drive away. I saw that personally, and I must say, I was on the side of the police. The Gundas always came out when there was trouble. I suppose they were the have-nots. They'd become that way for economic reasons, but they did not respect life themselves, and they would profit any situation where they could step in and rob and kill themselves if they got the chance.
How do you spell that name, the Gunda?
G-O-O-N-D-A. Gunda. It's a rough bazaar element. They don't respect the police. They'll do anything, rob, steal, kill, for their own personal gain.
And I suppose things were in upheaval then.
Oh, absolute upheaval. I think that, God forbid, if we had real political trouble in this country, and there would be looting too, by an element which is there, who in peacetime perhaps fill the jails. It's a difficult political situation. The do-gooders would say they're only what they are because of deprivation, and they have to. It's the law of the wild and the survival of the fittest, and when everything is turned upside down, they're in there to pick up what they can. Ethics don't come into it at all.
Did you see anything of the migration?
Yes, I did. I was able to... before that, if I may say, I was driving a truck in Delhi. I was there for about 12 days before I could get to Pakistan. There was no way of getting to Pakistan except to be flown over. And so I was waiting a flight to be arranged for me to go. Not only me, but there were others, of course. And as I was driving down, a bunch, about a dozen Hindus, respectful-looking, older men, held up their hands, pleading me to stop, which I did. I wasn't at all worried or scared by this. They obviously had some kind of trouble, and they begged me to stop. I could see they were waving, please, please, please. So I stopped, and they told me that in their area in Delhi, they had old Muslim friends who had been living in the same area, and who were their friends. They had known them since childhood, and they had existed side by side for hundreds of years as families. But now they said, we feel we cannot protect them any longer. The Gundas and others are out to kill every non-believer. I'm sorry, I'm getting this mess. They were ready to kill every believer, everybody who's a non-Hindu. And they said, can you please help them to go to the compound in which Liaquat Ali Khan, the Muslim minister in Delhi was so they could perhaps seek shelter there. So I said, well, where are they? So they said, Sahib, if you'll come with us, we'll take you nearby, and then as many families as you can get into the back of this truck. It was a three-tonner, held 30 or 40 people at a pinch, all standing up. We would be very, very grateful. So I did that. The road was clear, and this was in Old Delhi. In Old Delhi is about 6 miles from New Delhi, where the architect had his house and big garden. And they all crowded in, and they all bid farewell to each other. They had to leave everything behind. They could take very little with them, their houses, their everything they had in their house. They left to their Hindu friends, said, you use them before the things are robbed. I mean, you know, they traveled with what they could carry. Their lives were completely turned upside down. Well, they all piled in, old women, young women, children, babies, and all sorts. And we drove her to New Delhi, where I took them to Liaquat Ali Khan's house, who stood in a big garden. And there were police on the gates, of course. And they opened the gates when I said I had refugees that wanted shelter. They got out and they went inside. I couldn't believe my sight. I can't remember the exact acreage of that garden, but it was probably about 5 or 6 acres. Every square inch of it was covered. The flower beds, the lawns, the pathways. There were thousands, I would say, of refugees in there for their own protection, awaiting some way of being found for them to be taken to Pakistan. Whether they all of them made it or not, I don't know. Many were killed who went by train, made their own arrangements. What the government of India was able to do about this, of course, if it's I don't know. But a few days after that, I flew over to Rawalpindi, and where my regiment was, close to where my regiment was stationed, and I joined them at a place called Ojhri Camp.
How do you spell that?
O-J-H-R-I.
Ojhri.
O-J-H-R-I. Ojhri Camp, which was a wartime mud-built barracks and housing accommodation for the extra troops that had, and regiments that had been formed during the war, which was still in existence and was temporarily being used by the Pakistan Army to house my regiment, the Prince Albert Victor's Own Cavalry, which was now had lost its old title. It was no longer a royal regiment. It was just called the 11th Cavalry. We had been before, of course, the 11th Prince Albert Victor's Own Cavalry. Now they were known as the 11th Cavalry. I was the only British officer at the time. They were all Indian officers. The CO, I can't remember his name. I'm having seen him. I can't remember his name. No, as well
you're
as
doing very well, so please don't worry. It will come.